Welcome once again to Word on the Hills with me, Felicity Sidnell-Reed, my co-host Gwyn Sheltimer, and our guest this week, writer and horsewoman Janice Gannon. Each week, we visit with a local author or other persons involved with writers and readers. We ask them to introduce us to their work. We hope for a glimpse into their lives and to find out what prompts them to write. Then we invite them to read to us from their books. This week we're very pleased to have Janice Gannon as our guest. Welcome, Janice.
Thank you.
Janice Gannon is an accomplished horsewoman and riding instructor who has more than 40 years' experience in the industry. She began her lifelong love affair with horses as a child and later graduated from Humber College's School of Horsemanship. An early job in the horse industry took her to the racetrack, where she dived into the little-known world of the backstretch. Grooming and exercising horses, working on various racetracks throughout Canada and the United States. 10 years later, after working with a wide variety of human and equine characters, she moved on to successfully showing her own horses and schooling others in an empathetic approach to riding and training. After earning coaching certificates in both English and Western riding, she developed a unique style of teaching that focuses on the partnership between rider and horse. Her students value her approach of schooling horse and human together to become a smooth and happy unit. Tales from the Track is her first book. So how and why does a horsewoman become an author, Janice?
When I was a child, I was in school, I was always encouraged by my teachers because of my writing, and everyone saw me as a future author. But I really didn't have much to write about, and I read that in order to be a great writer, you need to live, and live an exciting life. Yeah. So I set out to live an exciting life and follow my heart. So that led me to the racetrack in time, and it was so unique. And most of the people there were uneducated. They were never going to write these stories.
But they had good ones to tell.
Oh, most certainly.
And you were just a young woman when you first worked on the track. Was it difficult to win acceptance in that community?
Well, it's a yes and no kind of answer, because women were just starting to come onto the track in great numbers. So there was a lot of prejudice against women. A lot of the men used to claim that women had ruined the racetrack. And
what kind of jobs did they do? Had been admitted to racing themselves, or they were jockeys, were they, or what were they doing?
Most of the people at the backstretch worked behind the scenes. Yeah. The jockeys are the few people that you see out in public, and the trainers. So those are the top of the pyramid. But, you know, we comprise the bottom of the pyramid, the hot walkers, the grooms, the exercise riders that actually did the grunt work and mm-hmm. brought the horses mm-hmm. to the top of their... And then we would actually take them over for the races, but we would hold them to be saddled and so forth.
Yes. Well, I'm just wondering what was so attractive to young women at that time and why they all sort of poured into the racetracks.
I think... Part of it was we were raised in the era of the Westerns, and we saw a lot of horses on, and it was a freedom. It was a place where people like me, who would never have been happy in an office job, could be outside. We could spend all day with our horses. It was very freeing and different.
Yes, I can see that. It would be very different. So tell us a little about some of the characters, human or equine, who most impressed you when you started working there.
One of my last bosses was a man named Red Miller, and he was typical of the colorful people that I met there. He used to brag that his nickname was Kick-Ass Miller, because he would drag the exercise boys off and give them a kick in the you-know-where. And he'd come to the track originally as part-time. His father made him have a good job. But this was an old man. When he died, they actually tucked bedding stubs in his fingers just to show his love of the track. For 3 weeks, you could do no wrong. And then for 3 weeks, you could do no right. But he was like a second father to me. He was almost the same age as my dad. And he was gruff and tough and hard to deal with. And we just loved him. One of the horses.
What about the horses?
One of the horses that I rode, his name was New Gold, but his nickname was Goofy Noofy. And when he came down the shed row, which is the aisle outside the stalls that's covered, he would kick up into the rafters the whole time. And I would be sitting up there just holding the mane, trying to stay on. Mm-hmm. And he was bucking all the way down, and people would just stand clear of Goofy Noofy.
Oh, dear. So did he buck you off?
He did get me off. But he didn't actually buck.
Oh.
He was coming up to a race. He was very fit. And he just shook like a snake and stepped out from underneath me. And I was sitting with my short stirrups, and then I was standing on the ground. But he once hit me with his tail in the middle of my back. He bucked so high.
So what was your initial inspiration for telling the tales from the track?
Again, it was just how interesting these people were, these experiences were, how we lived in a very much a gated community. And even if people came through, they were only seeing a very small part. Things that had been written about horses, and especially about the track, were written by outsiders. There was one book that I read, the guy spent 6 weeks on the track, as opposed to 10 years that I had spent.
Yeah.
Another famous book was just a sports writer who had a great interest and did some great stories, but he never lived on the track.
Right, right. So you tell the inside story. Well, how about reading to us from Tales from Track?
Sure. Chapter 4, The Little Bird of a Filly. Spring is a time of great optimism in racing circles. All of the horses are earnestly in training. The two-year-olds are still an unknown quantity, giving great hope to their respective barns. With time off to rest, the old campaigners are still sound. The warmer weather has coaxed the green grass up. The canvas that encloses the shed rows has been taken down. This leaves our barn open to the sunshine, adding to the enjoyment of the weather. My filly Magpie is now fit enough to race. The first two-year-old races have been written. One afternoon, I lead my two-year-old over the test barn to be tattooed. A burly man applies a rectangular clamp to her top lip and curls it back to expose the inner flesh. Each needle block is firmly pressed into the lip. Black ink is smeared across the inner lip, and the result is photographed. Maggie has been stamped with her permanent racing number corresponding to her registration paper. She is now officially set to race. Bobby finds a race and enters her. 2 days later, I set out for Greenwood. When I'm called to the transfer van, Bobby comes down to help load her. He takes the shank from me and tries to coax her up the ramp. She does not budge. Next, two of the van drivers try to lock hands behind her and push her on. Maggie pins her ears flat against her head and threatens to kick anyone, except me, who comes close to her hind end. Exasperated, the burly men confer for a minute or two. Then they turn the filly around and carry her on backwards. Her front feet are several inches off the ground. I swear she is smiling. She is so excited by the trip that she develops hiccups. In the receiving barn, she continues and bangs her stall door with her front leg, paws up the straw, and continues to hiccup. The hiccups continue all afternoon long, much to the entire barn's amusement. The track is greasy from a recent rain. As soon as Maggie leaves the starting gate, it is evident that she cannot handle this going. She is literally swimming in the mud. The rest of the field stretches further and further out in front of her. She is beaten by an embarrassing 31 lengths and is officially listed as outdistanced. Oblivious to her humiliating finish, Maggie cools out fine but is tired. Bobby has already left when I load her up on the trip home. She obediently follows me onto the horse van with no hesitation. 2 weeks later, Maggie is entered for the second attempt at racing. Her second race is almost a repeat of the first, minus the hiccups. Again, Bobby attempts to load her, and again the burly truck drivers back her onto the trailer. Her losing margin is not as dramatic this time. Once again, I load her for the trip home with no issues. Maggie has one more race at Greenwood. This time, Bobby leaves me to load Maggie by myself. She obediently follows me up the ramp. She is less anxious before her race, and the track is fast. She puts in a decent performance to finish fourth. The filly is sent to the test barn to cool out and have a urine sample. Maggie appears to be limping as she cools out, and she's still thirsty afterwards. Next morning, it is confirmed that Maggie has buck shins, the scourge of all young racehorses. This condition is almost exclusive to racehorses. As horses begin to get fit, the cannon bone below the knee starts to thicken in response to the stress of racing. It lays down a thin matrix of bone which grows stronger with time. Under the stress of running fast, this new bone growth can fracture. Buck shins is very painful, yet Maggie continued to run despite the pain. That shows real heart and class. Maggie is sent to the farm for 6 weeks to heal. When she comes back, she is still fat and fluffy, but conditioning starts again in July. She is deemed fit enough to race, and Bobby tries another jockey, Billy, on her. Bobby tells the jockey she might come up short, that he, Bobby, is giving her a race. Maggie does run well for the first part, then gets tired and fades to last. Bobby greets the jockey after the race to ask him about Maggie's performance. Billy said she came up a bit short, that he folded up and let her ease back. Then he asked Bobby to ride him back again. A couple of weeks later, I'm giving Maggie her final polish before taking over to the next race. The hot walker says, "Better get her ass shiny, because that's all they're going to see." Our whole barn is keyed up about the race. It's such a gorgeous summer day. I lead Maggie into stall 2, turn her around so she faces out. Jack, her owner, there is with Bobby beside me. The jockeys swagger out of the jock's room, secured their status as leading actors in this place. The first time I paddock a horse, I nearly laugh aloud at them. Dressed in colorful silk shirts, helmeted heads and tiny hips clad in white breeches making their hips look smaller, the jocks look doll-like, smaller than their actual size. Billy joins us for last-minute instructions. "Just take her back a bit off the pace, then move her up to the quarter bowl," Bobby advises. "She should be right there." With the call riders up, Billy offers his bent knee to Bobby and his boot is slid into the saddle. Maggie's race is textbook. She brakes well, settles back, and swings into contention at the top of the stretch. She duels down to the wire and wins by half a length. I am screaming my head off the whole length of the stretch. As the jockeys pull up on the backstretch and turn around, I walk out onto the track to await my filly. Bobby joins me, gives me a quick hug. Jack and his family appear for the wind pitcher. Billy rides the filly up to me. The track photographer has emerged from the grandstand and sets us up for the victory photo. The race is confirmed official and the payoffs are posted on the tote board. Maggie has paid off with a whopping $114 for a $2 bet. The highest payoff of the year.
Wonderful. Well, so thank you, Janice. Now we'll take a short break.